This is The State of Things. I'm Rusty Jacobs. The 7th annual full-frame documentary film festival kicks off today in Durham. For news junkies, story lovers, and film geeks, this is one of the best rituals of spring, gathering at the historic Carolina Theater for 4 days of screenings, panel discussions, and schmoozing. Martin Scorsese will be there, as well as Ken and Rick Burns. Oh, and of course, what would a festival in North Carolina be without barbecue, sweet tea, and banana pudding? And this year, the whole thing gets off to a juicy start with a showing of The Staircase, an 8-part documentary about Michael Peterson, who was tried for the murder of his wife, Kathleen. The film was produced by Denis Poncet and directed by Jean-Xavier de l'Estrade, and they join us now in the studio. Welcome back to North Carolina, gentlemen. And we say welcome back because you all spent a lot of time in and around Durham making this movie. My first question has to be, you're French, so let's start with you, Jean-Xavier, the director. What about this case? What about this man drew you to Durham and to wanting to tell the story?
It's a long story, because before that movie, that film, The Staircase, we did another documentary film called Murder on a Sunday Morning, which took place in Jacksonville, Florida, and it was a story about. It was also kind of crime story. It was about a black teenager, very poor, and who was accused of having killed a woman. And because he was poor, he had a public defender. And I think I wanted to do another documentary about American justice, but to take the opposite. Try to find a case where a wealthy white man, quite well-known or locally well-known, and to follow how when you are wealthy you can defend yourself and how you spend your money. And it took us 3 or 4 months in research to find that case.
Right. Well, and I want to follow up some of the things you just mentioned. Denis Poncet, as a producer, I assume it's your burden to go out and make sure there's backing and there's a support, financial support, other kinds for a film like this. What drew you to it as a producer? Why did you want to see this particular film made?
I think the first reason was I was interested in the lawyer, David Rudolph. And then, but I think the real thing that turned us on, all of us, I mean, Alison Luchak, one of our associate producer, and Jean and I, is Michael Peterson's personality. Mm-hmm. We met Michael for 3 hours without camera, nothing. We just talked. And we thought, this guy's intriguing. And we want to do a story about this guy.
I want to hear more about that. So before we get into more details about Michael Peterson, who's was the defendant in this case, give us a brief synopsis, if you can, a brief history of the case, what it involved, what the general story is, just so all our listeners know, you know, what we're talking about.
Well, it's Kathleen Peterson is found dead at the bottom of the stairs at 2:30 a.m. on the 9th of December 2001. And very quickly, Michael Peterson will give a call to 911, and the police, and of course the fire people and ambulance will arrive about 7 or 8 minutes after the call. And in a matter of hours, Michael is going to be suspected by the police of having committed a murder, and he says it's an accident. So this is the basic of the story, and he's a novelist. And quite well novelist.
Right. His wife was a Nortel executive. Yeah. She was. They were a kind of a high-powered couple in Durham. They lived in a very affluent neighborhood. He had run for mayor of Durham. Jean, I'd like you to tell me now about, you know, Denis mentioned how intriguing Michael Peterson was as a character. I mean, you're probably, when did you first hear about the case? It must have just been like anybody else through the news. Is that right?
Not really, because we were in Paris. In fact, and we had a team, 15 people, we were looking for a case. And I remember it was in January 2002, so it was only 4 or 5 weeks after Kathleen Peterson's death that a journalist from North Carolina called us in Paris and told us basically that maybe there was a very interesting case in North Carolina about a wealthy white man with a very good lawyer, David Rudolph. And we we went here, and it was not the first case we were looking in, but we were a little bit intrigued at the beginning, and we went here, we met first with David Rudolph, and a few weeks later we met with Michael Peterson, and really it was a meeting. I remember very well that meeting, because Michael Peterson was so deeply, when he talked about Kathleen, about his wife, he was so deeply moved, and I was really amazed by the man. I cannot say if he was guilty or innocent, but for sure he was really, really moved, and by the loss of his wife, and that was a very interesting starting point, because we, for sure, I knew that he cared a lot about her, and it was a kind of love affair, for sure.
I have to ask you both. It's one of the striking things about this film is your access is really seems unparalleled. I mean, you're telling this story in real time, focusing both on the prosecution and the defense teams, seeing how they
not
build strategy.
Not as much
strategy.
As we would have liked with the prosecution.
They were not as open.
Well, they were at the beginning, but very quickly they decided to close the door on us.
Do you know why?
No, I have a pretty good idea. I think I know why, yes. But can I say that? Yeah, I think if you look at the whole case, they didn't have much to go on. And they didn't want to show that they had to maneuver in a certain way with the media, because they used the media quite a lot. You know, you have to remember that in this case, one of the most intriguing part of the case is that it involves also the death of somebody else 17 years ago that took place in Germany. You probably know that.
Right. This was an old family friend of Michael Peterson and his
now,
first wife.
Yeah. The prosecution decided that they wanted to dug the body out, and they did this whole thing a few days before the...
Two weeks before the
trial. Yeah. And they didn't... The body was not... it was in Texas. They drove all the way back here, and they asked for the medical examiner here to do it here. Why here? Why didn't you send the medical examiner to Texas? No, you needed the media to really cover this and to make it a hell of it.
And then the local medical examiner ended up saying that it looked to him like a result. Her death 17 years ago was a result of an assault,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, which
murder.
Was rather a surprise.
Let me pick. Oh, I'm sorry, Jean.
Yeah.
Did you want to?
Yeah, about the access, because when you watch the film, of course you can be very surprised and amazed by what we were able to film, and it's right that I think the first time that in a documentary film we were able to really film every step of the defense, and we film all the focus group, we film all the meetings, strategic meeting, and we can really understand what were in the defense lawyer mind. But it was not so easy. We stay here 24 months, and it took very long time. At the beginning, Michael Peterson and David Rudolph were a little bit reluctant to let us to introduce as inside their strategic meeting. And
how do you overcome that? I'd really like to know how you negotiated this access in the end, because it doesn't come, there's no reluctance
well,
comes across in the
negotiation
film.
Was that nothing that we would be filmed would be shown before the end of the trial. And it was a written promise that we made.
Confidential agreement.
Confidential agreement on everything that we could hear. Mm. And so we didn't talk, we filmed, and nothing was shown until the end of the verdict.
I mean, you have Michael Peterson talking about very delicate subjects, about his own sexuality, which was an issue that came out in the trial and, you know, made for big headlines. You knew about all this probably before the readers. Since you bring up this whole case in Germany, this is one interesting aspect in the film. You know, when a filmmaker is writing a fictional script, you know, he kind of knows where things are going to go, where the twists and turns are. You've got incredibly dramatic twists and turns that you could never have known about. For example, you have David Rudolph, Michael Peterson's attorney, on camera saying, well, you guys just got a better film because of this revelation about this case in Germany. Yeah. Talk about that and about not knowing where the twists and turns are going to come from in a documentary.
Yeah, and that's really a very good feeling in documentary, and because you never know what you are going to film and what will be the story at the end. But so it's always also a challenge because maybe sometimes nothing happened. I want to come back about the first meeting with Michael Peterson. What we really felt that he was a kind of character, you know, bigger than life. And with this kind of character, you may have the intuition that something strange or a lot of surprise can happen. And at the beginning, we didn't know about his bisexuality. We didn't know about the Elizabeth Radcliffe death. About the discovery of the blood pack, of course. But I have the feeling that something could happen. A lot of surprise.
Imagine at the end of all of this, 670 hours of film, and we edited 6 hours and 30 minutes, 8 times 50 minutes. About Imagine the amount of film.
We have to leave. In 10 seconds, I'm just curious, did either of you formulate an opinion about Michael Peterson's guilt or innocence? Denis?
To this day, no.
Okay. I can only say something. I don't think he should have been found guilty.
Denis Poncet and Jean-Xavier de Lestrade, thank you so much. Producer and director of the documentary called The Staircase. Thanks very much. And it airs tonight at the Full Frame Festival in Durham, beginning tonight, 4 consecutive nights, beginning tomorrow night on the Sundance Channel. Gentlemen, thanks. Just ahead, where does the documentary impulse come from? Support for The State of Things comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and listeners who support North Carolina Public Radio, WUNC. This is The State of Things. I'm Rusty Jacobs. Are you the keeper of your family's stories? Do you save and organize photographs or videotape? Have you recorded or written down your grandparents' memories? We've been talking about documentary films on the show this hour, and we'd also like to consider other types of documentary work, both professional efforts and the things each of us does to document our lives. We're taking your calls at 1-877-962-9862. And joining us to discuss the state of documentary work in North Carolina is Tom Rankin, Executive Director of the Center for Documentary Studies at Duke University. Welcome, Tom.
Thank you.
And Melinda Maynor, filmmaker, historian, and currently teaching at North Carolina State in Raleigh. Welcome, Melinda.
Thank you.
And Robert West is with us. He's co-founder and executive director of Working Films. Welcome to you, Robert.
It's good to be here.
Okay, so we were just talking to Denis and Jean-Xavier about what attracted them to the Michael Peterson case, this, you know, sensational murder trial in Durham as a subject. So starting with you, Tom, where do you think the motivation to document comes from?
I think really two places. One is to tell stories, the sort of universal impulse to tell a story. And then I think a lot of documentary work is for many people, the universal impulse is a part of wanting to remember, wanting to reflect and remember. And to be able to do that and put together a story. You mentioned, people who keep the family history. I think documentary work does come out of somewhat of a universal impulse, the same impulse that has people make memory quilts and take family photographs and make scrapbooks. Professional documentarians take that to another level, perhaps, and with other issues, other agendas. But I think that's where it comes from.
Robert, where did you first notice your professional impulse to be a documentarian?
Well, I'm not actually a documentarian. Okay. I was a curator of media for 12 years and was screening a lot of docs. And I think that often those screenings, which were not that pervasive for audiences, that were sort of tough to find sometimes, for audiences to find really good documentaries that weren't really on TV at that time. But those screenings were often the most powerful, when audiences would be visibly moved and, those stories, often the story of one person's personal life, which seemed particular to the incidents of his life or her life, would resonate in very powerful ways to audiences, would translate the story to sort of say, there's something universal about this. And sometimes it was even hard to sort of nail down what that was. It's beyond the personal. Right. Sometimes the most personal and the most particular doc is the one that has the ability to reach audiences in ways that are more universal.
Melinda Maynor, you're a maker of personal documentaries like that. Tell us a bit about what your stories, what your documentary stories have been about, and if you can, also address that question of where this impulse comes from, and when did you first notice you wanted to take it to a professional level?
Yeah, well, I think it starts definitely where Tom and Robert have articulated. It began from a personal desire to tell a story, and growing up in an oral culture as a member of the Lumbee tribe, you know, we tell stories all the time. It's part of daily life. And so I didn't come to it from an interest in film so much, just as an interest in trying to remember, trying to talk about what the stories were that were important to me, and also wanting to fill a sort of gap, I think, in the media more generally about representations of Native Americans in general. I mean, so much of what exists in popular culture and in mainstream media is simply stereotypical representations that don't tell you much about daily life and actually have, you know, many negative or pejorative repercussions. So I got involved in it mainly as a desire to fill what me and my community felt like was a major gap in what people knew about us, and what people knew about being a Native American and Native American identity. So my films have basically centered around those particular issues, what it means to be a Lumbee, what it means to be a Native American and a Christian, for example, and then also Native American land use and spirituality more generally in my most recent film.
Melinda, and then I'm going to pass this question around the table, but Melinda, does this impulse to document differ from the impulse to, say, write about an experience through a novel or some fictional vehicle?
I think it does. It is a little bit different. There's something compelling for a viewer about what they feel is a true story, and there's something compelling about unrehearsed dialogue and the idea that someone is simply sort of pouring out their heart, as the guests earlier talked about the Peterson case and Mike Peterson pouring out his heart in the most intimate manner in that film. There's something that is incredibly attractive about that for viewers, who especially viewers who are interested in learning about other cultures or people or experiences that they don't have access to themselves. Novels and fiction filmmaking are certainly a good way to do that, but I think there's something unique about documentary that it offers.
Tom Rankin?
Yeah, I think Melinda's exactly right. There's a wonderful passage in James Agee's Let Us Now Praise Famous Men where he, and I'm paraphrasing, but where he's talking about the power of human actuality, that's his term, and says, you know, in a novel, a house is an imagined building, and a life is an imagined life, but in a piece of documentary work, we know that's real, and it carries a weight that is not necessarily any truer than the truth that can be in fiction, but it has more power for many viewers, and I think that is part of the reason people like to see documentary films, like to see documentary images, photographs. There's a power to that, and when you begin to, you know, Lewis Hines' photographs of child labor in North Carolina, say in cotton mills, knowing that that child really is working in front of that piece of machinery and is not standing there for just an instant to have a picture made, changes the way our relationship to that image. And so the political dimension of documentary really gets introduced or can be introduced by that actual experience.
Now, Robert, I was just, what have you seen people get out of documentaries they might not be getting out of a novel?
Well, we actually, you know, we started this organization, Working Films. I co-founded this with Judith Helfand, who is a documentary filmmaker. And the reason we did this was because we knew that these stories, these powerful, personal, pervasive stories, are very powerful ways to move audiences. We knew they moved audiences. And Working Films is entirely committed to using these stories as a tool for social change, because that's the potential all of these stories hold, is that they're really, there's a political aspect to them, there's a personal aspect to them, there's a community aspect to them, and unlike anything else, we knew that they embody that kind of potential, and we've been working for 5 years to use films in that way because they do hold that power, that personal, very persuasive power, but that it translates into, I think you can use that to get that out of an audience, it can be a very powerful tool for change.
Melinda Maynor, I'm wondering, is that at the essence of all documentary work, to be a catalyst for social change, or can documentaries aim for something maybe less noble?
Well, I think all documentary has some potential for nobility. Certainly the practice of it and is inherently about working with communities and within communities, working with people to get their voice into to a broader audience. So whether the subject of the documentary specifically relates to some political issue or is explicitly intended to promote social change of a particular kind or another, there's something about the practice of any kind of work, any kind of documentary work, that is inherently humanistic and deals with the subjects of human actuality, as Tom and James Agee mentioned. So I think social change can be broadly, very broadly defined through documentary, and it should be, because that's something that really encourages people to get into the field, and it also encourages small stories and big stories and the potential of all stories to promote, you know, the values that we share.
Tom Rankin, I wonder if you can draw a line for me between newspaper articles and documentary work. Both, I think, have something to do with putting out facts, mm-hmm. and giving reporting on a certain subject, but mm-hmm. does the documentary go farther?
Yeah, I think, and it's a frequent question of, you know, where is that line? The best way that I think about it, that I like to talk about it, and the way that I think about it is that documentary typically involves a much, much deeper involvement, deeper engagement over time. That's not to slight journalism. It has a whole different agenda and different schedule. But the documentarians hope to embed themselves in a subject matter, engage over time, reflect a little more. Oftentimes the form is a longer piece, but more importantly, the way of working is when we talk about doing documentary field work at the center, we really encourage people to collaborate with communities over a longer period of time than, say, you would to get news on a fire in a neighborhood. But what's the experience of fire in that neighborhood, and really engage with that idea and those reflections, and to try to reconcile the paradoxes that exist in the human experience that can happen in a documentary. So there is a lot of overlap. I mean, there really is. There's a lot that documentary folks can learn from journalists, and vice versa. And I think there's a very good investigative reporting. The best tradition of that in journalism is very close to investigative, hard-hitting documentaries. But there is a distinction, I think, and we see it and we feel it.
Robert, in going deeper, though, how common is it for documentarians to go too deep, to perhaps pick a side? Do documentaries often falter in trying to go deep and end up falling kind of off the that balance beam between, you know, of objectivity?
They might, but I think that the best documentarians understand that the way that all stories have many sides, and the way to engage an audience is to let that audience come in at some point that, you know, has access. So that the idea is that if it's a firm, if there's a hard line and there's an agenda, it's an agenda-driven doc, it actually is not going to be very useful for us, for instance. And while we're committed to using these powerful stories in very relevant grassroots organizing, what we understand is that the best docs to do that are audiences that are docs that let audiences in any number of points and don't necessarily push to change their minds. That there has to be a sort of a natural engagement and then a little bit of a time to understand that. And I think certainly at the end, when the credits roll, do we want audiences to be changed? Yes. Do we want them to be more thoughtful about whatever the issue is? Yes. Do we want them to feel like we're taking a hard line, and if they're not with us, they're not with us? No.
Someone out there must be wondering, wanting to ask someone here at the table whether Fahrenheit 9/11 was a documentary or a feature film, or, you know, just a regular blockbuster film.
I think, and Melinda, I'm sure, has something to say to this, but I want to say, before we get too far into the objectivity question, that it is a myth that documentaries have ever been objective. It's a myth that any piece of decent artistic expression has ever been objective. That doesn't mean, as Robert says, they have to be so one-sided that that an audience can't enter at different points. But the documentary tradition started in a social reform tradition in the late 19th century, and it's always been a part of it. It's evolved. The documentary tradition now includes very personal work that reflect on personal identity and may not really connect with a overt political cause, but they're very subjective looks at a personal life. The points, Lewis Hine had a wonderful saying about photographs, that photographs don't lie, but liars can often photograph. And that if you go to a documentary and think you're seeing, you know, unmediated truth, you're really in a bad spot. And if you think a documentary is just an objective, completely balanced view, on the other hand, the best documentaries do balance lots, but they have a point of view, and having a point of view means, you know, you have something particular to say.
Melinda Maynard, what responsibility does the audience member have to being somewhat skeptical when they sit in the seat and settle in for a documentary?
Well, I think it's like approaching any other form of media, whether it's, you know, a long-form documentary or a story on CNN or a story in the newspaper. You have to recognize that the creator of that particular story has got a point of view and perhaps even an agenda that they're trying to articulate, that the voices that you're hearing are subjectively chosen, and the pictures that you're seeing are even more so subjectively chosen. So I think that kind of critical approach, you know, it really only strengthens the viewing experience. I would hate to think that the majority of my audience for my films accepted what I was saying uncritically, because I'm doing it to foster dialogue, you know, about the issues that I care about. And one of the things that's so important about what Robert and Working Films does is they carry the film, the experience of watching a film, to a dialogue after the film is over, and even after the event is over, way into the communities that are concerned about those particular issues. And so I think people need to approach documentary like they approach processing any information in their lives.
Robert, maybe now would be a good time for you to just briefly tell us about your organization's mission and why it's so good to be based right here at, in North Carolina.
Well, I think we're a nonprofit organization that's committed to using these compelling, personal, persuasive films that tell these triumphs and struggles of our lives in very specific, grounded, intentional organizing campaigns. In other words, the works the projects that Working Films works with are all documentaries, but they're all documentaries that have some form of social justice aspect. They're either films about the environment, or they're about sexual orientation, or they're about race. And we believe that they are unique and very powerful tools to engage audiences, and then when the credits roll, to actually give that audience not only the opportunity to talk about that issue, but actually to do something about it. Not only do we want to create space for dialogue, we also have typically developed very, very specific list of direct actions that we want to, if people are with us and they're ready to act, we want to give them very specific and relevant direct actions that are actually part of the movement connected to whatever the issue is that the film's exploring. So the idea is that that's something that grassroots organizers have been wondering, I think, how to use media. We're creating, I think, new tools for grassroots organizers, and for documentary filmmakers, we're actually embedding their films into very, very relevant grassroots organizing, and very smart and strategic, and we're actually seeing real success on that.
Tom Rankin, just how many potential documentary filmmakers are out there? I mean, is there a real desire out there to do more work like this?
I think I don't know that I've ever seen, or that anybody's ever seen, documentary expression in the largest sense as popular, and documentary film may lead that charge. But you also see it in documentary radio, the number of young people that want to learn to be documentarians and use audio. Part of it, I think, is the democratization of all this media with the digital format, and it's much easier to get into. There's a downside to that, with sort of everybody has a microphone, but a lot of people don't have anything to say. I mean, it doesn't necessarily, just because you can get a camera doesn't mean you're a filmmaker. And so there's a lot of uneven work. But it's a rich time, and I think I get asked a lot, you know, why is it so pervasive? And I think that in our sort of relatively disconnected and virtual and global world, if I can generalize for just a second, there's a thirst in many people to tell local stories and to localize experience and to ground their telling and their lives in a more placed way. And documentaries do that. They allow you to explore other people's lives while also exploring your own, which we know both of those are important things to do. And then you add to it the working films kind of mission, which is to find ways to really engage in community life for the betterment of all those people in community. And documentary work is a great catalyst for that. And I think that's not to diminish its value as an art form, but it can be a really wonderful art form and a powerful catalyst for revising our notions of how we want to live.
Melinda Maynard, we just have about 30 seconds before taking a break, but how is it that the local or more personal stories seem to resonate with even wider audiences?
I think there's sort of a need for specificity in our culture. So much of what we see on television and in the mass media has to do with global stories, things centered in Washington and New York and places that we really can't relate to on a daily level. So seeing someone else's experience, even if it's someone that we don't know, someone from another place, you can usually tap in some way to that person's daily life and understand where they're coming from. And I think there's a need for greater understanding.
Let me stop you there, Melinda. We'll be back in a second talking about documentary work in North Carolina with Tom Rankin, Robert West, and Melinda Maynard. Just ahead, more of your calls, 1-877-962-9862 on The State of Things. Stay with us. This is The State of Things. I'm Rusty Jacobs. We're talking about documentary work here in North Carolina with Tom Rankin, Executive Director of the Center for Documentary Studies at Duke University, Melinda Maynard, filmmaker, historian, and currently teaching at North Carolina State in Raleigh, and Robert West, co-founder and Executive Director of Working Films. And we're taking your calls, 1-877-962-9862. What are you motivated to document in your life? Tom Rankin, let's start by just taking a quick look at the history of documentary making in North Carolina, which has a tradition, I guess, going back to the 20s or 30s?
Yeah, I think that you know, you wonder why full frame here? Why is the Center for Documentary Studies in the Triangle? And you know, there's different ways to think about that, but it's important to look at really this University of North Carolina, and its role in the 20s and 30s with Howard Odom and Guy Johnson and some people in the social sciences who were recording African-American work songs, who were going out and gathering and documenting the lives and voices of all kinds of people, realizing, as Melinda was saying, that without those voices on the record, there's an unfair and unrepresentative understanding of people and creativity in our culture. And so UNC, and then later the advent of the starting of the curriculum in folklore here and films that have been made in that curriculum, and then the Center for Documentary Studies at Duke. And I don't think it's any accident. And people come from out of town for the film festival, and they sort of wonder, well, why Durham, North Carolina? Well, I think there's a lot of things you can look at, and many more than I've just mentioned. And then the center's founding about 15 years ago. And this has become a place where film and documentary expression flourishes, and people move here. We have people move to Durham to do a certificate program, a continuing education certificate program, from Montana, from New Orleans, from China, to come and be in a community more than just take courses. I think it's to be in a community of people thinking about this.
Are they going back to their communities, or is there a glut of documentarians here in the Triangle?
Many of them are going back to their communities. I'd say we have a high density of documentarians here, but you know, a lot of these people, truthfully, are trying to learn these skills. They may already have a PhD, but they want to learn to do documentary radio, to go along with other things they're already doing, or they may be working in neighborhoods and they want to use film to energize that work. So there's lots of different, quote, agendas, unquote, for using this work. And I think that's one of the powers of it. Working films being in Wilmington, North Carolina, makes perfect sense to me. And I'm sure there are people around the country that wonder why Wilmington, North Carolina. But it's an ideal place for it to be. It's a great resource for the whole state. And the film community in Wilmington, but also the documentary community in North Carolina and the Southeast.
Melinda, has North Carolina become a home to kind of this thriving documentary community?
I would say certainly it has, partly due to the efforts of Tom and Robert and another organization, the Southern Documentary Fund, which is a relatively new organization designed to provide fiscal sponsorship and other training and networking services to documentary filmmakers in this area. And that's another good reason for Full Frame and all the documentary activities that are going on right now to be here is, you know, the availability of networks and information training programs and things that exist in larger cities and like New York and San Francisco and Austin, Texas, have existed for a long time, but are here uniquely situated in an area with a very rich history, history of local activism and local involvement. And so I think that the place and the organizations that are here just make the documentary work that much richer.
Melinda, how is documentary filmmaking changing? Are there myriad styles of telling a story? Is it just you just go out there and get a few people to sit down on camera and tell you about an experience they went through? Just how creative can it get?
Well, there's a zillion different styles, and that's what's exciting in particular about the Southern Documentary Fund is that it's not just oriented around short or long format films, but also photography, radio, mixed media, lots of different things. So I'm working on a project right now that involves two other women artists in North Carolina, two Tuscarora artists, and we're working together to create a documentary film that also involves mixed media collage work and music in particular. And that film really tells the story of Tuscarora people in North Carolina and Tuscarora history. So there's many different themes and strands and styles that you can weave into a documentary film, or documentary work in general. I think one of the obstacles right now is the exhibition formats for those kinds of things. You know, television is still very much oriented towards a particular style of film or style of work, and I think the audience is hungry to see other things, so there's a sort of a challenge in getting the work to that audience.
Let's take a call. Phil from Durham is on the line, and I think, Phil, you've got a bit of a criticism of documentaries. Is that right?
Yeah, I have some. I must say, I heard about the Center for Documentary Studies about 10 years ago, and it's always left kind of an uneasy place in my stomach. Two things. First off, I think many of your participants in the discussion there have talked about that certainly things are not supposedly even-handed. They're actually oriented to make a point. Things are very subjectively chosen. Things are very subjectively written and edited. So why instead of calling it a documentary, why not just call it muckraking cinema or propaganda or something like that? The other concern I've always had is I find some of this can sometimes be very patronizing. It seems to be too much of overeducated, middle class, generally left of center, and often white people kind of filming and looking at the kind of societal oddities. You know, let's look at the rural people, let's look at the poor people, let's look at the minorities.
Well, Phil, let me put your question. I think I have a full table of people who want to respond to you. I'm going to go to Melinda first, only because we're going to lose her in about 2 minutes. So, Phil, hang on for your answer. Melinda Maynor, does Phil have something here? Are documentaries just a nice word for propaganda?
Well, no, not necessarily. I mean, I think that there's, as I said before, lots of different ways to do documentary and lots of different labels you can put on it depending on whether you particularly agree with the point of view being expressed. You know, one of the nice things about the current access to materials is that lots of people can go make their own muckraking or propagandistic documentary film. If they don't like what's out there, there's plenty of opportunities to go make your own. But that relates to his second point, which I think is a very important criticism and one that I've encountered throughout my work, is the idea that access to these materials and to the funding to make these products has been limited to a certain segment of our society traditionally. It's beginning to expand, but sort of the anthropological or ethnographic tradition in documentary film has emphasized this looking at the other as if, you know, there's some kind of mainstream or centrist point of view that other should reflect or should help us understand. And, you know, that's simply not the case. There's many centers and many different points of view that can be put forward. And so I'm all for opening up the access to materials and access to resources so that lots of people can make these films.
Let's say goodbye to you, Melinda, and then I'm going to continue this discussion with Tom and Robert. Melinda Maynor is a filmmaker, historian, and professor of history at North Carolina State in Raleigh. Her current project is an outdoor drama in Robeson County, North Carolina. You can learn more at www.strikeatthewind.com. Melinda Maynor, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me on the show.
Tom Rankin, I know you guys are eager to jump in, so yeah, could pick up on what Melinda was talking about.
I think Phil's point, really, there's some real validity to this idea that historically documentary has been people going out from centers of upper middle class, learned places, making films about other places and bring them back. But that is the old, and thankfully, a model of documentary work that we've evolved from. And the exciting thing about documentary work now is the notion of collaboration. We, at the Center for Documentary Studies, there's as much work done to put cameras and tape recorders in the hands of kids in Durham, for instance, for them to document their own communities, their own neighborhoods, as there is for people, you know, from a university campus to control that representation. There's, in our continuing education program, which is, you know, not university students, people from age 20 to 70, 400 students this year, 72 courses, really geared toward exactly doing something more along what I think Phil would be satisfied with, which is not this patronizing point of view. It often is a very personal point of view, and it may be subjective, and some of those people may not, Phil may not agree with, but it's not at all that that idea that there are some documentarians and then there are the people. We, I think, have gladly moved from that, and there's a much more open, collaborative theoretical model, and a much more, in fact, it's happening. And I would invite him to look and maybe refresh the image of just what documentary looks like.
Robert?
You know, I agree. I think the field has shifted, and I think now folks are very critical of outsiders, whether it be from a family or a community, going in and telling someone else's story. I think the field now raises very serious questions around that particular kind of filmmaking. But the reality is that's most of the media we get anyway. I mean, most journalists, most broadcast are not members of the communities of the stories they're telling. They couldn't possibly be. So I think that actually, ironically, I think in documentaries, I think that's the one place where typically you do have someone from which the community that embodies the story is that's the person who's telling the story. I mean, I think that's really the place now where those stories are happening.
Right. We have just about a minute left. Now, both of you are giving awards at the Full Frame Documentary Film Festival. Is that right? Can you tell us briefly?
Well, annually, the Center for Documentary Studies gives a filmmaker award to a film that really embodies the mission of the center, that is long, deep involvement in the community and collaboration, some of the things we've just been talking about, a $5,000 cash award.
And Robert West?
We have this is the first year we're giving a Working Films Award, and it's basically to the film in the festival that we think has the most potential to be a catalyst for relevant, urgent social change. So there's a $5,000 cash and a $5,000 in-kind services from Working Films.
Right, thanks very much. Tom Rankin, Executive Director of the Center for Documentary Studies at Duke University, and Robert West, who we just heard from, co-founder and Executive Director of Working Films. Thanks to both of you. And thanks to all the listeners for the calls. For more information about the Full Frame Documentary Festival, check online at www.fullframefest.org.